Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. Sitting in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader. This is a show I've been looking forward to doing for quite a while. As you followed me on Coast to Coast, aside from my interest in all things supernatural, true crime has been a part of my world, unfortunately, because it was brought into my world, and I lost somebody through a very violent crime, and I'm always fascinated by these stories. Why do people do the things they do? Why do normal people turn to abnormal routines or actions? How does that happen? And being a fan of pop culture, being a fan of rock and roll music, I've been fascinated. As our Gary Patterson had joined me, we've talked about everything from the Beatles' Paul McCartney death hoax to the 27 Club and beyond. And these aspects of our history are fascinating to me because, let's face it, one thing that ties us together is our love for music. And I've mentioned it briefly on the show before. In about 1985, I faced a very dark time in my teenage years. Now that I look back at it, of course, it's easier to smile and realize just how silly it was. But at that moment, it was devastating to my teenage psyche. And I looked down the darkness and saw suicide as my only option. And went into my father's room, took the pistol out, put it in my mouth and pulled the trigger, and it didn't fire. So I did it again and again, three attempts, and the gun would not charge. The bullets were in, the safety was off, but the gun would not fire. Just then, the headlights of my father's car panned across the room, and I couldn't put my father through that. I knew it would be bad enough to walk in and find his son dead, but I couldn't let him hear the shot and know that he was that close. So I put the gun back and just retreated to the darkness of my room. I slunk over to my stereo, threw on my headphones, flipped on the radio, and just started to tune out. And the song Dancing in the Dark by Bruce Springsteen was on, and I just sat there phased out, not really paying attention, not really listening, but just taking my mind out of the moment that I was in. When the song ended, I switched the dial, and boom, it started again for me on another station. And around the third dial spin, I catch Dancing in the Dark another time, and all of a sudden these lyrics just start to fill my head. And as a teenager, you're feeling isolated and broken because you don't have the years of experience. You don't have the yardstick of experience to measure how insignificant the little hiccups are that you're facing right then and there. And you feel like nobody's ever been in this place before. And now here's this candy-coated, sugary pop song, and I started to hear the lyrics. I started to hear the message. And Bruce Springsteen talked about not liking who he was, not liking his look, his clothes, his hair, his face, not liking his life, where he was. And these words flooded my mind, flooded my heart, and I heard these words. You can't start a fire sitting around crying with a broken heart. You can't start a fire worrying about your little world falling apart, and it lifted me. And that night, no more than about 10, 12 times, every time I changed that dial, I caught that song on different stations. And it resonated with me. And that night, rock and roll saved my soul. And that meant something to me. And I've had this fascination and this tie to music. And not everybody has that luck of finding that light that reignites them and keeps them from that dark path. I had a rock musician that saved my life with his music. And in 1994, a very prominent figure in music, somebody that had captured the imagination of teenagers and young adults around the world, Kurt Cobain with his band Nirvana, was taking over. And people loved the music and the popularity, and watching this everyday looking guy, this everyday kid doing something and doing it extremely well and owning that. And then came the news of his tragic passing. And it set off a domino effect, because many teenagers around the world heard of this and saw, well, if this is how Kurt Cobain faced bad times and negativity, maybe this is my way. And there were suicides, copycat suicides that took place. And that's heartbreaking. And I know with the music and the demons that he poured out in his own songs, that was never the intention of what Kurt Cobain would have wanted. He certainly would have never wanted to lead somebody down that path. So for people to take that message, I know that that did him a disservice as a musician and an artist and somebody passionate about life. And then I started to hear these rumblings, these strange assertions that maybe the suicide was not exactly what it appeared to be. Maybe there was more to this story. And a few years ago, I was introduced to this documentary, Soaked in Bleach, and it really opened my eyes. And tonight, we're going to examine the Kurt Cobain case. We're going to look deeply into this and examine some real problems and flaws in our system. Because this case, this documentary, opens up a dialogue about crime and about law enforcement and about humanity that we need to revisit. So whether you already think you have a preconceived notion of did he or didn't he, did somebody pull the trigger, did somebody overdose him, was there another deal, that will be a part of our discussion tonight, but that's not the important part of the discussion. There are two important parts tonight. The first being that whatever your belief is in this case, it was handled improperly. And justice has not been served for Kurt Cobain. And if there really is something more to this story, he, his family, his friends, and his fans deserve an honest answer. So we're going to explore this case and ask, why is the Seattle Police Department not willing to reopen this case to give the answer once and for all so that it can be put to bed? What happened to Kurt Cobain? And we're also here to talk about the fact that even in your darkest moments and in your escape into music, there are other options. And that if this was suicide and this was what was going on in Kurt's mind at the time, it was a point that not all of us have to go through, that you don't have to go through. There are other decisions. That is a very permanent solution to a temporary issue. If you're in that dark place right now, if you feel like hurting yourself or others, there's a number. Call it 1-800-273-8255. They are on staff 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they have people that can help you. It's free, it's anonymous, and they're available to walk you through this and help you and give you answers when you're in these dark places. Let the music save you, let the music open you up, but you don't have to follow in the lead of the people you love and respect. Learn from the mistakes that they've made and be better about it. We're going to open up this case file tonight on the mysterious death of Kurt Cobain. We'll be speaking with Benjamin Statler, a filmmaker who directed, wrote, and produced Soaked in Bleach. Tom Grant, a retired private investigator and former detective with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, he's here with us tonight in studio. He personally investigated Kurt Cobain's alleged suicide and did it on the authority of Courtney Love. And that's what makes this story even more fascinating. There are twists and turns, and you need to hear about this. We need to re-examine this case. We're going to do that tonight on Coast to Coast AM. We are back. This is the best in overnight talk radio. Sitting in for George Norrie, I'm Dave Schrader. Tonight, we're going to take a look at the Kurt Cobain mystery, the murder, the suicide, however you want to look at this. We're going to look at different aspects of this case. And joining me this evening, by line, we've got him on the line right now, Benjamin Statler. He's a filmmaker, a director of Soaked in Bleach, which chronicles the Kurt Cobain suicide conspiracy. He also wrote and produced the film under his production company, Montani Productions. And Benjamin has been the executive producer on such projects as fan favorite Comic-Con Episode 4, A Fan's Hope, and the fact-based Navy SEAL thriller Act of Valor. Soaked in Bleach is the first in a trilogy of docudramas to be produced by his production company, and Ben will also be producing and directing other projects, which primarily will be based on true life stories. We'll be joined in a short time by Tom Grant. As I mentioned, he's a retired private investigator and former detective who was hired by Courtney Love to look into the disappearance and what happened to Kurt Cobain. Welcome to the show, and thank you for joining me tonight, Ben.
Well, thank you, Dave. And thank you so much for having us on here. It's actually, you know, from the get-go, my vision for Soaked in Bleach, the movie, was to bridge the truth of Tom Grant's investigation to the mainstream, you know, to a really big audience. And, of course, Coast to Coast Radio is exactly that. So you're truly the fulfillment of my vision with this movie. So I just sincerely want to thank you for that.
Well, I'm so impressed with the work that you did with this documentary of opening the idea that we need to question. And it's okay to question, and we should do this. But you have a unique perspective. I just talked about my story. Tell me a little bit about Ben Statler, and why is this story so important to you?
Yeah, thanks for sharing that as well. That's really, you touched on, you know, the really passionate aspect of this, and then the way it's affected so many people, Kurt Cobain's life and his music, the way you were touched by Bruce Springsteen, who I'm also a big fan of. But yeah, Kurt is he's pretty much my favorite artist of all time. And so needless to say, when the news came out April 8th of 94, it felt like Novocaine came over my body. I was just in shock. And I was 20 years old. I wasn't suicidal, but I was 20 years old. And we know that that's, you know, that time is not necessarily an easy one for a lot of people. And I've been through a lot of things. There was a long story with a girlfriend from childhood and just, you know, various things like that that are coming at that time. And just going through, it was a challenging time of life, and you're holding on to certain things. And for me, much like what happened for you, there was art that helped me get through a lot of things. And Kurt was especially that, and a lot of his music, like specifically the song Penny Royalty was something I always said. It felt like Kurt stepped inside me and expressed how I felt better than I could. He was my poet hero, and he was a rope I was holding on to. And he helped me to basically process a lot of these feelings. And I realized in hindsight what a powerful force that was. So when I was in that place and then I was told that my hero made this choice to end his life, that's not a good situation.
Right.
It's not a good influence. And, you know, now since I've learned the history of all this and I've learned about an 18-year-old kid named Daniel, who 2 days after the April 8th pronouncement by the media that Kurt had killed himself, Daniel was at a vigil in Seattle for Kurt Cobain, and he went home and blew his head off because, you know, he believed his hero did that. So, and he was the first of 68 that, you know, we mentioned in the movie, and these 68 are just the ones who say in their note, basically, because Kurt did, I'm doing this. And from what I've read from Psychology World, it's usually about 15 to 20%, maybe some will say 25%, actually leave a note. So if you do the math there, and we don't presume to know all the ones who left the notes, I think we're easily in probably 300 or 400 copycats who, because their hero did. So there's, how do you measure that, you know, the impact, right, of that? You don't. So it was just a really powerful thing to me, and took me a long time to get over. And then it was in 1998, I believe, when I first saw, I was walking through Blockbuster and I saw Nick Broomfield's movie, Kurt and Courtney, on the shelf, and there was no time to think about it. I grabbed it immediately and took it home and watched it. And there were quite a few good things in that movie that got my attention and, you know, got me to thinking that way for the first time. And of course, it was through that movie that I learned about Tom Grant. But for whatever reason, I never really thought to look into Tom that much, you know, right after that. And years later, randomly, I did. I Googled Tom Grant, and I came across the website, which basically changed my life forever, which was CobainCase.com. And so I began reading it, and I was seeing all this stuff. And I actually felt a little bit ticked off when I found his website, because this whole thing meant so much to me, and I was basically wanting to believe what, you know, it seemed to be was being indicated on his website, that maybe Kurt had not done this and left his baby girl behind. But I felt like, you know, it's more than likely someone just trying to bring attention to themselves. And then I saw there was even a link to audio recordings he had, and then I thought, oh, this is really going to get shaky, what's going to come up here. And I clicked, and then lo and behold, there they were, these actual audio recordings that just, you know, really blew me away. And right away, I just could not get over, like, how is this not on CBS? How is this not on Rolling Stone? And I was just dreaming right away, like, how do we get this out to a bigger audience? And it wasn't long after that I decided to pursue filmmaking. And as soon as I decided I was going to pursue filmmaking full time, the idea of a documentary on Tom Grant's investigation was immediately my first choice of what I wanted to pursue.
With that, let's take a moment. You found this information. You found these actual audio clips. Now, when you say that, what kind of audio clips were on Tom's website that really raised your attention, that there was more to this story than just some guy trying to cash in on his whacked out conspiracy
exactly
theory.
Another cuckoo bird playing with my emotions.
Right.
Yeah. He had the actual recordings of, you know, talking with Courtney, and she's telling Tom, you know, what she's going to plant in the media. And I guess that was the main one that got my attention that stands out the most, because, of course, I had based my opinion on what I heard in the media. And then I realized all these things that I believe from the media is, you know, what is being planted. And so that made me want to look into it more. And I also, you know, heard the audio recordings of Tom with Rosemary Carroll, who was the entertainment attorney of both Kurt and Courtney. And, you know, Rosemary was going on, and then she did not want to come around, and so, you know, that blew me away. And then, of course, there were recordings of Tom and Kurt's best friend, Dylan Carlson, going through, and so I realized there that Tom really was on the scene, you know, right as this whole thing went down.
Right, this wasn't some armchair quarterback that was reading online news stories and making his own leaps and conclusions. He was hands-on, actually in this investigation.
Precisely, yeah. Which there, and of course, there are a lot of the armchair detectives, and
right.
Yeah, it's a lot to do.
Well,
with
I know
all
I've been getting emails from them the last 2 days when they realized we're doing the show. So, well, introduce us to Tom Grant, who's here live in studio with me this evening.
I'd love to. Yeah. So I actually when I pursued filmmaking, I moved to LA in 06, and I realized I needed to learn the industry first. So, after so many years out here, I finally got the nerve up to call Tom. I felt like I was finally ready to start, you know, pursuing what I wanted to do. And I called him in 2011. I believe it was May of 2011, actually. And I emailed him first, and then we set up a phone call. And when we talked, you know, I explained, and I was concerned that he would just think I was, because I'm sure he deals with a lot of kooky people. But he, for whatever reason, he gave me some time and talked with me and seemed open to the possibility. And at the time, I was actually looking at calling the movie Smells Like Murder. And it still is my opinion that there was foul play involved, although that's not the conclusion of the movie at this point. And that was actually the point that Tom made to me that kind of realigned my focus in a big way. And we talked for 5 hours that first time, but that is the thing that stands out the most. When he saw my passion of getting it out there that, you know, how I believed Kurt was murdered and getting people to believe this. And Tom said, well, actually, the bar is much lower than that concerning our goal. And I was like, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, actually, if we can just get the Seattle police to change the findings from suicide to undetermined, in relation to what their own reports actually say. According to what their own reports say, the findings actually should be undetermined at this point. So if we can get people to realize this fact, this truth, then you know, the world is going to really pressure the police, as they should, to determine it once it's undetermined. So,
are you aware, are there any times that, and we're going to talk to Tom when we come back from the break here, but have there been any cases where outsiders pressuring the police actually worked in getting them to reopen?
You know, I'm actually not really aware of other cases where the police are being pressured into doing that. That's something I'd probably defer to Tom on where there's actually been success there.
Right. I'm so curious because there are so many cases out there where there are wrongful convictions and glaringly wrongful convictions and shoddy workmanship done by the police department. And yet these people don't seem to get a fair shake. What's it going to take for law enforcement to re-examine, to reawaken the chance of, we need to make sure that justice is served in this case?
Yeah.
And if it means we have to put a little bit more manpower into it, we need to do this. It needs to be done because that's what the ideals of law in our country are, right? Is to give justice, to give the answers so that we know where we stand and not just take the easy way out of saying, well, hey, this is a kooky rock star. He's got a drug problem. There's rumors that he's tried to commit suicide. So this is a pretty cut and dry case. It should never be cut and dry. It should be investigated. It should be researched. And the right choices should be made in closing this case when it is fully fleshed out and they know where they're supposed to be with this.
Agreed. And my observation is on this case specifically is that the Seattle police, for whatever reason, find it inconvenient to reopen this case. So I've always been telling this army now of Cobain case supporters that we need to make it even less convenient for them to not reopen the case. And so we all need to get focused and raise our voice and speak as a whole. For
check out the documentary Soaked in Bleach. It's on Netflix. SoakedInBleachTheMovie.com. And check out CobainCase.com as well for more information, some of the audio bits. And I want to make sure we take a moment to wish a very, very happy birthday to the master himself, Art Bell. Happy birthday, sir. We'll be back with more. You're listening to Coast AM. I know many of you have questions, many of you have thoughts, and we will open up the phone lines, but we'll do that in the last hour of tonight's show. So please hold your calls till then. And if you do have questions, thoughts, concerns you'd like to send to me, you can always email me, Dave@darknessradio.com. That's Dave@darknessradio.com. I will try to sprinkle your questions throughout the show as we continue. I'm sitting in for George Norrie today, and if you love what you hear on Coast to Coast AM, then I encourage you to check out George Norrie's TV show, Beyond Belief with George Norrie. There's seven seasons in, over 266 episodes available. The brand new episode is about climate change and the Vatican with Daniel Sheehan. There's also a free episode you can check out on the site right now, The Truth on UFO Cases with Nick Pope. If you've never seen Beyond Belief, you should treat yourself. Go check it out. If you love what you hear on Coast to Coast AM, you're going to love what you see with George Norrie on Beyond Belief. And speaking of George, he's got a busy schedule, and he's got something coming up. If you'd love the chance to meet with George and see him one-on-one, well, here's your opportunity. They have the Eat and Greet Luncheon Series at the Great Greek Restaurant in Sherman Oaks, California. The next one coming up June 27th, and that'll be George Norrie and Rich Martini. You can enjoy gathering with other like-minded people as you have fun at lunch and meet some of your favorite people in the world of the unknown and curious. Tickets always go fast, so reserve a spot now. How do you do that? Well, email in your name and your phone number to lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. That's lunchwithgeorge@gmail.com. You'll be called back with the details. And right now it's Tuesday, June 27th, lunch with George Norrie and author, researcher, Rich Martini. And if you'd like a longer extended stay and hear even more, make sure you check out George Norrie's live performance at the historic Everett Theater in Everett, Washington, coming up Saturday, July 29th. From radio to stage, you can enjoy the grand experience coming to you from Danheiser Wagner Entertainment, which brings the world's number one late-night radio show host to the stage. Enjoy watching the host of Coast to Coast AM, Emmy Award winner George Norrie, interview some of today's brightest experts in the world of ufology, paranormal, conspiracy, and all things unexplained. This is a three-hour stage show that consists of interviews combined with video, music, and singing, which create an unforgettable experience for theatergoers and fans of the hugely popular Coast to Coast AM radio show. For more information, check out coasttocoastam.com. Click on George's tab and look at the events that are coming up, and you can keep up with all of the different ways you can see George Norrie. When we come back, we're going to continue our journey into the mystery surrounding the death of Kurt Cobain. We'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. Benjamin Statler on the line with us right now, talking about the documentary that he wrote and directed, produced, Soaked in Bleach, which chronicles the Kurt Cobain suicide conspiracy. And at this time, we're going to turn over. Tom Grant is a retired private investigator and former detective with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. He personally investigated Kurt Cobain's alleged suicide and was actually hired, if I'm correct on this, Tom, back in April of 94 by Courtney Love personally.
That's right. April 3rd of 1994.
And she brought you into this case to do what? What was the interest at that point?
Well, initially she called because Kurt had fled the rehab 2 days before that on the 1st, on Friday night. He'd fled a rehab in Marina Del Rey. My office was in Beverly Hills. She called on Easter Sunday, actually, but we happened to be in the office working that day on another case, and the client was there when Courtney called. I told her, she wanted me to come over to the Peninsula Hotel, and I told her it would be a little while before we could get over there, but a couple hours later, I went over there, and I took my guy that worked for me, named Ben Klugman, and we both went over there to see Courtney.
Talk to me about that. I mean, were you aware who you were about to talk to or what you were about to get involved with at that point? Did it have any... Did it ping your radar at all?
Well, the only thing that was strange was her attitude on the phone and her demeanor and all that. That was bizarre, but you get that a lot as a PI. I wrote down her name because she said, me and my husband are kind of famous. And so I wrote down her name for Ben because Ben was a lot younger than me. And he goes, oh. And he went into the lobby, and we had a People magazine sitting on the coffee table in the lobby, and he brings it back and he opens it up, and there was an article about an incident that happened about a month earlier between Kurt and Courtney, and he brought it in and he opened it up to show me this is who we're talking about right here. And gradually I was recalling that I'd heard the name Kurt Cobain before and a little bit about him, but I was basically unfamiliar with him, and certainly I didn't know who she was.
You just brought up a great kicking off point for this. You talk about the fact that it was an article that appeared about a month before,
right?
In a celebrity rag mag.
No, it was People magazine.
People, yeah. Right? Okay. What was this original news story that broke? What was the gist of it?
That was an incident. If I recall correctly, that was about the incident that happened on March 18th, where Courtney had called the police and said that he's in the bathroom and he's going to kill himself. And the police showed up, according to their own police report. They were able to talk to him. We found out later that he was actually standing in the backyard, but it was reported in other media stories that they coaxed him out of the bathroom. And he apparently had some other weapons in there, some handguns and things like that. But he also told the police that he wasn't going to commit suicide. There was no way. And Courtney admitted to the police after that, and this is written in the police report, that she admitted that he never said he was going to kill himself.
And again, this isn't speculation. This isn't secondhand account. It's in the police,
report
that, right, when they got there, he really wasn't in the bathroom holed up with many other weapons. He was sheepishly standing in the backyard,
exactly,
embarrassed by the situation that was unfolding.
Exactly.
And he wasn't showing any signs of depression, anger, anxiety. He was just embarrassed
by
what was
going on.
They were
just having a fight, basically,
right,
a domestic fight. And she called the police, and in order to get them there really quick, she said he was suicidal. And then she later admitted that he didn't say anything about suicide. So, you know, that's what happened that was reported in People magazine. And a lot of the details that were reported were furnished to People magazine by Courtney. So a lot of those details were wrong.
So now we're already beginning to set a precedent that some of the reports that are coming out about Kurt Cobain's mental state leading up to this suicide, there are many variations, but the legal variations, the legal details from the actual police reports don't match up with the accounts that are being told by Courtney Love.
Right. Yeah. From the time that I began talking to her and we went over to the Peninsula Hotel and started a discussion about the whole thing, most of what she told us was just didn't make sense, contradicting statements, things that didn't add up, like telling us that he didn't have any money, he didn't have any friends. By this time, of course, I knew this guy was a multimillionaire and had a band, and obviously somebody like that has friends and can get a hold of money with a phone call. If he didn't have it in his pockets, he could get it. So just things like that that she was saying in the statement. And as a former police officer and a private investigator, whenever somebody is missing, you have to really pay attention to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first thing that happens when somebody ends up dead is they go missing. So when you take a missing persons report or you're hired by somebody to locate somebody that's missing, you have to really pay close attention to what you're being told and to what's going on around you. And that's exactly what I was doing. And I wasn't convinced he didn't commit suicide for several months after they found his body, but I knew right from the beginning that things just weren't adding up. This just was real suspicious to me. So that's how the whole thing started. And then from that point on, we were on the phone. Me and Courtney were on the phone sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon, and we'd be talking for a couple hours at a time. And this went on until finally, a few days later, I flew up to Seattle myself to search for Kurt with his best friend, Dylan Carlson.
It took that long to decide to actually go to the site. Why would Courtney not have gone to the home that they shared to check and see if Kurt was there?
Well, of course, I said, you ought to go up there. Somebody else in the room also said that to her. You know, you ought to go up there. And she said, I can't. I've got too much business here. I learned from Rosemary Carroll, her own attorney later on, and the person who she travels with most of the time and is by her side most of the time. Rosemary told me she didn't have any business in L.A. She didn't have to stay in L.A. So, again, these things that kept happening, these conversations that kept happening, are just raising more and more red flags. But I did subcontract with a private investigation firm in Seattle, and they began a surveillance of a couple of locations that Courtney wanted watched. And they started that on Monday morning, the day after I was hired. And then we kept in touch, and I kept feeding back information to Courtney as to what was going on. One thing is, though, she had me watching a drug dealer's house and a couple other places. At one point, she even wanted me to watch Dylan Carlson's apartment. But she didn't want us watching the main house. And we found out later, the next day after I had first talked to her, that Kurt had been seen. After he left L.A., he flew up to Seattle, and he'd been seen at the house.
And was she aware of that? She knew that he had been seen there?
Callie told her that he had been there about 6 o'clock in the morning. Callie says that Kurt sat down on the bed and woke him up, and they talked for a couple of minutes, and then he just disappeared or whatever.
Well, let's introduce Callie. Michael Callie DeWitt. Who is Callie to the story?
He's a former boyfriend of Courtney Love's.
Mm-hmm.
He was a heroin addict at the time, but he was also being used as Frances's nanny. Frances was Kurt and Courtney's little 2-year-old girl.
Wait a minute. Courtney's ex-lover is the heroin-addicted nanny of Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love's child, Frances Bean.
Living at the house with them and acting as a nanny.
Progressive relationship, I guess.
Right.
Okay, so,
yeah.
Well, if he's living at that house, did he do a walkthrough to investigate to see if Kurt was there and check around to see what was going on and report? I would have thought he would have reported back to Courtney. Nah, he's not here, and that would have made her report to you. Oh, I already had Callie check the house. He's not there.
Exactly. She was on the phone all the time to Callie.
Okay.
Sometimes when I was with her, sometimes when, you know,
that would make sense then of why she didn't want you to go to the house, because she already had somebody at the house, right?
Well, yeah, allegedly. But then, you know, once the body was found, the first question that comes up is, how come Callie didn't check the greenhouse?
Right. We'll get into that. I just wanted to make the point, though. I mean, you can see that if she felt like he might come home, I've already got somebody covering that. I need you to cover these locations.
That was the alleged excuse.
Okay.
All right.
And she talks to you about doing this. At what point do you start seeing red flags pop up that you almost feel like you're on a wild goose chase?
From that first meeting that I had with her and the things that she was telling me. And she said she canceled his credit cards so that he couldn't do anything. He couldn't get money. He couldn't travel. She was afraid he was going to fly back east somewhere, which we believe now that he was. And he had tickets to fly back east and probably to go stay with Michael Stipe for a while. But she didn't want him getting out of town.
Okay. Now, this is intriguing to me because you're a former police officer.
Yes.
Right? You're now working as a private investigator. So you're not required by law to follow up on this case. If you're starting to see red flags and you realize this just sounds weird, did you ever have the thought at the beginning, you know what, I got enough other cases I can go to. This one just sounds like it's going to be a headache.
Well, no, that's not my job as a PI. And I was being paid very well from the beginning by Courtney.
So it was worth investigating because the money was good, even if you have to put up with some craziness.
But within 30 days after I started working for Courtney, I sent her a letter telling her I was suspicious of what was going on. And I ended the letter with, I'm going to continue my investigation with or without your cooperation. That was telling her, really, that I think you're involved in this somehow. That was within 30 days after Kurt's body was found. So I did my proper, my ethical duty towards her. And when I was talking to...
How did she react to that?
Yeah, when I was talking to Rosemary Carroll and I told her about that, she said, oh, she's going to be livid. She's going to call you yelling and screaming. And I was just waiting for that phone call, and I got it. And she goes, oh, you know, Tom, there's some other things I want you to do. You know, I'd like you to go get a background check on my father. You know, and she started sending me off on all kinds of unrelated stuff.
Why did she think her father might be involved in hiding
Kurt? It was a cat and mouse thing. It was a way for her to keep in touch with me, to keep lines of communications open, instead of me saying, I'm going to do this on my own. No, I'll have a reason to keep calling you and talking to you and saying, so what's going on? What's the latest and all that?
So she didn't try to dissuade you from continuing your private investigation of this case?
No, she knew she couldn't.
So she just decided to keep your enemies closer.
Play along, cat
see what's
and mouse.
Going on. Okay,
little cat and mouse game.
Right, and that's and we'll continue to open this story and explore it. And we're not here tonight to point fingers at any one person as possibly being the suspect in a possible murder. We're here to talk about the fact that there was a lot of balls dropped by the legal form, and that has been the gist of this documentary. And I know a lot of people. Ben, we lost Ben on the line. Did we get him back on? Yep. Okay. All right. Are you back with us now, Ben?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. I know we were having some connection issues. I'm glad you're back online with us here. Your main focus, a lot of people watching this documentary, again, like you thought when you were dealing with Tom, is this guy just trying to cash in? You weren't trying to cash in on this. You were trying to just give due what was due, and that's justice. Let's get the case examined the right way so that there's no shadow of a doubt how this went down, really.
Absolutely correct, and I like what you said. We're not here to point fingers. As a matter of fact, I would like to point out specifically that we are not here to point fingers, and it's really, we need to get away from that and get the focus to where it belongs, which is on the Seattle Police Department. Because as I've said many times before, I have my opinion that it was foul play, and I feel confident in that opinion. But right now, it just seems there's an army of Cobain case supporters, and they seem to really. They're fascinated with Courtney, and they're fascinated with expressing anger at certain people and who they think did it and all their different theories and all of this. And it actually serves as a distraction from where we need to be. And, you know, the goal of Soaked in Bleach, again, was to bridge this focus to the mainstream. And it's been a little bit frustrating with people not getting the focus to where it needs to be, which is on the fact that the Seattle Police Department need to give this an investigation according to common protocol.
And here's something that I took away from watching the documentary. I've watched it four times because, again, I'm fascinated. And I'm looking as an armchair detective myself at this case to see where the documentarians are coming at it from, what the law is doing, where it falls apart. And it's a beautifully crafted work of art in the fact that although you're shining lights into potential suspects or potential ideas of what might have happened, the most important message I got from this was that it wasn't done right the first time. So if you can shine a light on something and remove the shadow of doubt that it was just suicide, that should be easy enough for the law to see and say, yeah, that's right. This does look a little screwy. Why don't we just... Let's just clear the slate here. We'll just check this out. I wouldn't think it would take too long. You've got crime scene photographs. You've got experts. You're forensics. You got CSI. We've come a long way in 24 years since Kurt's death. That should be a no-brainer. I would guess that within 90 days to maybe 6 months, a more thorough investigation could come in to look at this case. Are there too many police officers still on the force that were part of that case that maybe... You know, we don't want to shine a bad light on them, yeah. So that's why they're trying to back off?
It does seem to be that there are some, well, there certainly are some who were there then, and there's one in particular who, he's really seemed to express a concern or an interest about this movie. There's one I'm not sure if I want to name him, but he actually was emailing, a Cobain Case supporter telling them that this movie would never get distribution. And I'm thinking, why is that his concern as a police officer? But he seemed to be very concerned about that. But yeah, from what I gather, there's certain forces within the police force that are keeping this from going where it needs to go.
It gets stranger, folks, because when we come back, we're going to talk about Norm Stamper, the former chief of police in Seattle, who was part of the force at that time. What does he think now that he's had a chance to objectively stand back and look at the entire picture? He's no longer close to this. His reputation is no longer on the line. What does he think? And does the Brotherhood of the Blue Line stick together? Or does he see that there may be some issues with this case? We'll discuss that. We've got a lot more to cover tonight, and we'll take your calls in the last hour of tonight's show. That's the final hour. You can reach us at that time, and you can email me, dave@darknessradio.com, if you have questions, thoughts, and concerns. We'll be back. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.